Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Finding the story behind a global superstar. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today, a new film explores the life of Bob Marley. Later, a live performance in our studio from the Minnesota-based bluegrass group Trampled by Turtles. Plus great new music in our weekly Pick 3. In the pantheon of pop music gods and goddesses, you'd be hard-pressed to find a deity more globally revered than Bob Marley. His music and his image still have universal appeal today, more than 30 years after his death. But sometimes the story gets lost. The new documentary, Marley, aims to tell that story. It was directed by Kevin MacDonald, whose past films include The Last King of Scotland and the documentary One Day in September. Bob Marley's son, Ziggy Marley, is part of the estate that authorized the film. When I talked to them last month, I started by asking Kevin MacDonald if Bob Marley's legend has obscured the story behind the man.
I think so. That's why I wanted to make the film. I think when you see anyone who's become an icon, the impulse of the documentary maker is usually to kind of scratch away behind and figure out, you know, who was the man.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what, you know, compelled me to make the movie. And I think that, you know, even people who know Bob's music very well and who feel they know quite a lot about him will discover a different Bob, a different person, and it's a very human person.
Yeah. And Ziggy, there is a generation of fans who've grown up since your father died. What do they need to know about Bob Marley?
I think that they need to know he's much deeper than just a ganja-smoking reggae singer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that went into him becoming who he has become and what he means to them, and they should know all of that, all of what made him what he is, you know. So I think that's something important for them to know.
Now, you know, most of us know about Trenchtown partially because Bob mentions it in several of his songs, you know, growing up in this kind of shanty town in Jamaica. But early on in the movie we see his struggle with his own identity. You know, the son of a black mother and a white father. How important was that to, you know, to his early life, to his path to becoming the musician that we know?
Well, I think my reading is that it was hugely important, and that maybe that's the defining aspect of him, is this dual identity that he had. And I think that growing up in the countryside in Jamaica, in central Jamaica, he was neither accepted by the kind of black farmers around there nor by the white population. He was a kind of outcast. He was in between. And I think he also grew up without a father. His father wasn't really around very much at all. I think he met him a few times. So he was always looking for a father figure, and he found that father figure in Rastafari, in the Ethiopian emperor who is worshipped in the Rastafari religion.
Haile Selassie.
And he, I think Bob used his, the drive that was given to him by this lack of acceptance was the motivator for his success. I think it was, he wanted to prove to both the black community and the white community, you know, I can be somebody. You know, you maybe don't have a high opinion of me now, but wait till you see what I can do.
Yeah. Ziggy, did he ever, I realize he would have been just a little kid, but do you recall your father ever talking about this part of his life?
Yeah, and one of the hidden, one of the things he always kind of secretly wished for is that he was black. He did wish he was darker in complexion. I've heard that, you know, a few times, you know, growing up with him, you know, that, you know, him just, he wished that, I don't know why. I mean, obviously the film goes into that part of him, but there's something in him that was conflicted with the, with that mixture that, that he had, you know, and growing up. And since he was singing about a lot of the struggles of the black man and the black people, he had that thing in him that kind of, that I don't know if you call it an insecurity or what, but there was that thing where he kind of wish him was one way, you know?
Well, I think you're using the right word. I mean, we think of, you know, Bob Marley, this man who sort of whose music strides across the globe, and you know, we all love the music and we love the man behind it. To think that there was this kind of insecurity there really humanizes Bob Marley in a way that is I think Kevin goes back to what you were saying about, you know, why you took this film on in the first place. We're speaking with Kevin MacDonald, the director of the documentary Marley, and Ziggy Marley, oldest son of Bob Marley. The film opens in theaters this Friday and will also be available through video on demand. And Kevin, there's a great scene in the film involving the song Cornerstone. Can you set this up for us?
Yeah, it was something I was told by a man who was probably Bob's greatest friend in the late 60s and early 70s, a man called Alan Skill Cole, who is Jamaica's greatest ever footballer. Mm-hmm. And Bob famously loved football, and he played all the time. And he kind of worshipped Alan Cole, I think. And Alan told me when I interviewed him, he said, you know, it was a time when Bob was looking for money to start his new record company, and he went to see his father's family, the White Marleys, who had a big engineering firm, construction firm rather, sorry, in Kingston. He went to see them to get some money from them, to borrow some money to start his business. And supposedly they threw him out of the office. They didn't want to have anything to do with him. Mm. And so he went away and he wrote this song, Cornerstone, which is, the key lyrics are, the stone that the builder refused shall become the key cornerstone. And obviously he's talking about the builder is his own family, is the White family who are in construction, and he's going to become the key cornerstone. The one that they've rejected, he's going to become the important one.
So he's
and there's a very moving couple of interviews around that with one of Bob's cousins on the White side and with his half-sister.
Mm-hmm. Constance, yeah. So in the movie, this song, Cornerstone, and again, taking this kind of biblical imagery of the stone that the builder rejects and building a song around it, this song in the movie is played for his half-sister, Constance, and the reaction's really interesting. Here's the song by Bob Marley. Bob Marley's Cornerstone, and we're speaking with Kevin MacDonald, director of the documentary Marley, and Ziggy Marley, oldest son of Bob. His own latest album's called Wild and Free, and he also hosts the show Ziggy Marley's Legends of Reggae on Sirius XM. They're both with me on Soundcheck today. So, Kevin, when Bob Marley's half-sister Constance hears this song, what's her reaction to it?
Well, I think it's a song that she hadn't heard before, and I explained to her what I felt was the significance of it, what I'd been told was the significance of the song by Bob's great friend, Alan Cole. And you can see, well, it's one of those great moments in documentary where you can see something happening in front of the camera. You know, she's thinking about something for the first time. This thought is forming in her head. And she says, you know, that the White Marleys, they thought themselves to be so wonderful, so grand, that they could reject this relative of theirs who was mixed race and who was a Rasta, but that now that Marley, Bob Marley, he's become the Marley, and everyone has forgotten about the others. Everyone's forgotten about the white Marleys who thought themselves to be so grand and so fine. And it's a very, very moving moment because obviously it also applies to her. She felt that rejection as well. And so somehow the pain of what she and Bob both felt is transformed into music. And I think that's the key with a lot of great artists, and particularly I think with Bob, that he took some of the difficult things that happened in his life, some of the struggles, and he transformed them into beautiful music.
Mm-hmm. Ziggy, you and the rest of the Marley family, you endorsed Kevin's film. How involved were you guys in the sort of the making of the film? I mean, we see a lot of family stories being told. Some of them, you know, would have been things that I would have thought you wanted to sweep under the rug. Was this a chance to really just kind of air everything out?
Yeah, this was a chance. Show Bob in a light that everyone can relate to, as not just a legend or an icon, but someone that, normal people who's not in that position can relate to. And we were involved in it. I mean, personally, I was involved with it deeply. And then the first time I met Kevin, when his name came up, you know, I met with him and we spoke about the ideas of the film and stuff like that. And, you know, it was like, yeah, Kevin seems to have the right idea that this what this film should be. And so let's go with Kevin. And also to gain access to a lot of the individuals who knew Bob, It would have been much more difficult if we weren't involved, for just like any director, anybody making a film about Bob to just go somewhere and say, hey, I'm making a film about Bob, can I talk to you?
Right.
Our involvement made that access a lot easier. So, you know, those are the ways that we kind of helped to put this film together. And also giving Kevin access to the photographs that we have and some footage that we have, you know.
Mm-hmm. Your mom, Rita, is very frank in the course of the film yeah. about, you know, your dad's many girlfriends and how she yeah. felt about it. I mean, had yeah. you heard her talk about that before?
Not in that way, not at all.
And
we were kind of kept a little protected from how she felt about that.
Right. One of the key interviews, Kevin, in the movie is Bunny Whaler, the only living whaler of the original three. Ziggy's talking about how you were able to gain access to some people through, you know, the good offices of the family. Bunny can be a notoriously difficult guy to get.
Heard that, have you?
Yeah. Did the family help you track Bunny down?
Well, I think Ziggy tried to help. I think everybody tried to help. But the great thing about Bunny is he's his own man. He's not he can be influenced by anybody. And I think he's got very conflicted feelings about Bob. In one way, I think there's a little bit of jealousy, a little bit of bitterness. But also, he loves him. So he's kind of torn.
Mm.
And he grew up with Bob, and they knew each other from when they were, you know, 10 years old or 8 years old or something. And they share a sister because Bunny's father had a child with Bob's mother. A woman called Pearl,
mm-hmm.
and so they are family, really. So there's love and there's jealousy and there's bitterness, and it took a long time to persuade him to talk, but when he did talk, he gave us his all and was fabulous and completely frank and honest, and you can feel his love coming across, and he has the most amazing memory for every detail.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like a lot of Jamaicans, this beautiful use of language, amazingly inventive use of language. And so it's a real pleasure to listen to him, and it's a pleasure to listen to a lot of the people who talk in the movie.
Let's actually hear a little bit from Bunny Whaler, who, by the way, refers to Bob Marley here as Robbie. So when he says Robbie, that is Bob Marley. This he's talking about after Bob Marley, early in his career, had moved, believe it or not, to Delaware, where he worked for Chrysler, the Chrysler Corporation. And then when he comes back from America as a young man, this is where Bunny Whaler picks up the story.
When Robbie came back from the U.S., we decided to start our own independent label. Wailing Solem. So we went in and did Bend Down Low. Bend Down Low was the number one. We started to build our own economy. We used to ride with our bicycles and distribute the record to jukeboxes, sound systems, record stores with our bicycle.
The song Bend Down Low, as you heard Bunny Wailer talking about. So it's Bunny Wailer, Peter Tosh, Bob Marley. Bob had gone to Delaware. And what was his job, Kevin, for Chrysler?
Well, he used to drive the forklift truck in the night shift. And he wrote a song about that later on. I think that he went because he wasn't earning any money in the music business. And he was getting frustrated. He was writing all these great songs. He was recording with Studio One, and they used to get, I think, something like £10 for every song that they recorded that was released, and it wasn't enough to live on.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt like they were being mistreated, I think, by the owner of Studio One. So I think Bob actually thought of giving up music, and he went to Delaware, where his mother had gone a few years previously to work. He went there thinking that he might never come back. He might be just part of the migration. They got a lot of Jamaicans migrated to all parts of North America. But after having been there for, I think, about 8 or 9 months, he just decided he couldn't stand it.
Mm.
And he had to get back to Jamaica. He had to get back to music. You know, his mother said, somebody, an interviewee says in the film, you know, his mother said all he used to do is sit in his bedroom and play his guitar, and he never went out, he never got to know anyone. He didn't like it there. He hated it. And I guess it's one of those things, he had to do it to realize that music was his life, and it was the only thing that he wanted to do.
So the song that Bunny Wailer was talking about, Bend Down Low, becomes a big hit. They get no money from it. And he does go back and makes a second effort at it. And at some point, you mentioned Alan Cole, this professional soccer player, this footballer who was Bob Marley's friend. He becomes manager of the Wailers, and in this clip from the film Marley, talks a little bit about their negotiating their way through a thicket of figures on the Jamaican music landscape.
In the music business, there were just prejudice. The first problem has been a Rasta, and the next problem is that you're not with the big companies. So that's a heavy load to carry. These disc jockeys, when they went on air, they had their own programs sometimes. They had their own sets of records from these different companies that they would have to play. Sometimes we were not included. So to be included in that, we had to get real tough sometimes.
Kevin, when he says we had to get real tough sometimes, what does he mean?
Well, as somebody goes on to say afterwards, what he means is that they used to sometimes go round with baseball bats. And somebody else says, but why did they have baseball bats? They don't play baseball in Jamaica. They used to go around with baseball bats to the DJs and kind of threaten them. I don't think they ever actually beat anyone up, but they had to get, you know, heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And they would say, play our record. And one of the musicians in the film recants how he was the wimpy guy. He would get to stay in the car and he would listen on the radio for when they actually played the song, so that they could be sure that actually the DJ was playing it was going out on air.
and Ziggy, I mean, you know, the Jamaican music industry in your dad's day sounds like a really tough and potentially violent place. How does that compare to today?
I think today the whole thing back in those days was that they had so much going against them, including the idea of Rasta, and Rastas were outcasts, basically, in that society. And obviously, the radio stations were controlled by money and people who had money, and Rasta didn't really have any money. Today, it's much more easier to, you know, everything get played, but there's still a lot of money going around. You know, there's a lot of payola still happening, mm-hmm. You know, but that's because there's so much poverty there that if you don't hustle, you know, it's very hard if you don't do a hustle, you know. So there's a lot of hustling still going on.
At what point did it change where, you know, where being a Rasta meant you were an outsider to being a Rasta meant you were sort of cool? When did that happen?
Well, it took some time, you know. I think it happened probably, what did I say, you know, 79, 80, like, you know, right before my father passed away, and a lot more after, actually, Rasta became really cool, you know, because Bob Marley was the biggest thing Jamaica ever had in the world, so, and he was a Rasta. And red, gold, and green, every time people say red, gold, and green, they think it's a Jamaican color. They don't know that it was the Ethiopian color. That's when it really became big, you know, and dreadlocks and everything actually became exported as a style throughout the world, you know. So it's a lot of it happened really after Bob passed away too.
That's Bob Marley with the song Ja Live, singing about Rastafarianism. His oldest son, Ziggy Marley, is here with us, along with Kevin McDonald, director of the new documentary Marley, which opens this Friday in theaters and through video on demand. Kevin, there is some incredible footage of Bob's funeral procession. Was this one of those things where we read about, you know, the singer Umm Kulthum in Egypt, or, you know, where the singer dies and the country just shuts down for 3 days? Was it one of those sort of events?
Yeah, totally. I think that footage is incredibly powerful and incredibly moving at the end of the movie, where you see this outpouring of grief, this spontaneous outpouring from everybody in Jamaica, and the roads are just lined with people all the way from Kingston up to Nine Mile, which is where Bob was born and where he was buried. I think that's, what is it, about 60 miles or something like that, Ziggy, or something like that.
Yeah.
And you can see on the film that all the way, there's just outside every school, all the school children have been led out of class to see Bob's funeral, Bob's coffin go past. There are grown men crying by the side of the road. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary atmosphere. And it just indicates how important he was to everybody in Jamaica. He was the kind of patron saint of the country.
Mm-hmm. And there's someone in the film says, perhaps somewhat provocatively, that Marley got bad advice from people around him when he got sick. I mean, you know, do you get the sense that his death was avoidable?
Well, it's so hard to know what to say about that. I think that yes, it was avoidable if Bob had cut off his toe or cut off his foot when he was told that he had a melanoma on his big toe, but he didn't want to do that because he wanted to. The two things he loved the most in the world were playing soccer and performing.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that it was going to affect both of those enormously, and maybe he couldn't do either of them ever again. So he sought out a doctor who said, no, you don't need to cut anything off. You just need to have a skin graft. And he took that advice because that was the advice he wanted to hear, I think. And he then had this minor operation on his toe. He had a skin graft, and he never went for checkups. And, you know, that's bad advice. It's just somebody who's so believes that they're healthy, and he looked so healthy and he was so strong and he exercised so much, and I don't think he felt bad, so he didn't feel, why do I need to go for checkups? It's all been sorted out, it's dealt with.
And as we see in the film, this part of the story is of course very tragic. Bob Marley died of cancer in Miami in 1981. He was 36 years old. So the film Marley is done, many years, many directors in the making, but Ziggy, there's long been rumors of a biopic about your dad. Do you think that would happen? Is there anybody out there who could play your dad on screen?
Not that we know now. You know, there's always this people coming and you know, film companies wanting to make a biopic. But until we're sure, You know, I think the documentary here, what we're doing now, is the best representation of Bob. If doing a biopic one day will do anything for his legacy or anything to further the story or do something that is meaningful for him, we won't consider that until that time comes. You know, right now, I think this documentary is what we're focusing on, and I think we all appreciate this documentary as being the definitive film on Bob right now.
All right. Well, Ziggy Marley, oldest son of Bob Marley, his latest album's called Wild and Free. Kevin MacDonald is the director of the documentary Marley. This Friday, the film opens in theaters and will be available through video on demand. Kevin, Ziggy, thank you guys so much for being with us on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Up next, new music in our weekly Pick 3, and then later, live music from the Minnesota bluegrass band called Trampled by Turtles. They'll play live on Soundcheck.